Hello everyone and welcome back to the third episode of the new season of the Stats for Lefties podcast. Today I'm talking to a very special guest, which is Jack Frayne Reed of the Real Politic podcast, very successful long-time podcast on the left. And we talked about the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, alternative media, dealing with attacks from mainstream media, and lots more. As with the other two episodes, the first part of this is free, and if you want to hear the full extended episode with a little bit more fun content, you can subscribe to my Patreon at patreon.com/leftystats from £2 a month. With that out of the way, let us keep it real. First of all, very nice to meet you.
Oh, you too, absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
No, I've been listening to Real Politic, I think, for like 5 years of various... No, it's fantastic stuff. I will say, in large part, started Stats for Lefties because of Real Politic.
Oh, wow. What, like the podcast or the whole enterprise?
Partly the whole enterprise, because basically you... for two reasons, like, because basically you guys... I suppose it's you who runs it, basically, isn't it?
I guess I'm the showrunner in American television terms.
But yeah, no, I mean, you guys not only made an independent media thing very successful, but also it was very cathartic to hear what you guys say about stuff. So it was like, well, I mean, if they can make a go of it saying what they believe, then I can do it too. So thank you.
That's all we could hope for, you know? I'm glad to have Stats for Lefties on the scene.
Oh, thank you.
It's always very informative.
You have infamously been calling Keir Starmer's leadership a right-wing ideological project. You may have noticed, I should have really credited you. I started using the term. I was like, I should credit Real Politic for this, and then it was too late.
I was happy to just see it doing the rounds, you know. I feel like in politics, you can't be too kind of protective of your intellectual property, so to speak. You've got to kind of, the further it gets, the better.
So obviously you were calling him that long before he even withdrew the whip from Corbyn, I think before he sacked RLB as well.
Oh, probably.
And obviously there were those of us who were skeptical of him but didn't think he'd go that far. But you called it very correctly. What made you... I was going to say think, rather, what made you know from the start that he would be like this? What were the warning signs for you?
I'm glad to have called something right. I've got to say that. you know, like anyone else, I've made a lot of errors in judgment the last few years. But yeah, I think the signs were there pretty early on that Keir Starmer was going to go in a particular direction, which was all about returning the Labour Party to a position where it's something that capital can be comfortable with and something that the apparatus of a British state can be comfortable with, as well as, I guess, their other kind of vector of power, kind of centre to right-leaning newspaper columnists. They've won Labour's good graces back with those as well. But of course, that kind of involves a lot of changes from the Corbyn era. And some of those were like personnel wise. I think maybe the first thing that made me really realize that what the nature of the Starmer project was going to be was the appointment of David Evans as General Secretary. Because there were a lot of names floated. There were some, I mean, honestly, I could not tell you if there is any great ideological difference between David Evans and Emily Oldknow, who was considered by Starmer for the General Secretary, and she was one of the names in the leaked Labour report. But you know, there were some other people floated, like there were no hope names floated, like Andrew Fisher, former Corbyn aide who wrote the 2017 and 19 manifestos. I mean, the fact he wrote the 2019 manifesto kind of says, well, Starmer's was never going to hire him, you know, someone that closely associated with the Corbyn project. But like, even if he had left by the time of the last election, the leader's office. But the point is, like, bring them up, but like, there were other choices. There were ways that Starmer could have gone, but he went for David Evans, who is, you know, I can't tell you if there's any notable ideological difference between him and Emily Oldknow, but he certainly seemed like the hard right candidate for General Secretary for Labour Party, to put a guy who was a kind of unadulterated Blairite, unreconstructed, in charge of the kind of entire the bureaucracy of the Labour Party. And in fact, I think it wasn't so much that, it was the fact that he asked for Jenny Formby's resignation from the position in the first place, not just, and then of course went on to replace her with the most hard right figure. But the idea that Jenny Formby had to step down as, I'm sure she wouldn't have wanted to work under Keir anyway. She did more than anybody. If the idea is that the Labour disciplinary processes were tarnished by their association with anti-Semitism, and thus the General Secretary must step down, Jenny Formby did more to address those issues than you know, any other bureaucrat in the party. So I saw right then, okay, Starmer is somebody, as has been borne out subsequently with his treatment of Rebecca Long-Bailey, Jeremy Corbyn, and a wealth of grassroots members, who is prepared to use human beings as pawns on his chessboard, and is able to say, well, look, I know you didn't do anything wrong, but you've got to go anyway.
It did feel mind-boggling because Ian McNichol was not sacked under Corbyn. His predecessor, I believe, McNichol was recruited under Miliband about halfway through his term. So his predecessor was also not sacked. Like, the idea that you should have continuity of general secretaries, it was just a normal thing. Like, there's nothing in history to suggest that Formby should have been sacked, like, new leader, new general secretary. No, that was not normal, and that was very, very odd. I mean, sure, there would have been a greater gulf in ideology than normal, but if there was a broad church, it should be able to accommodate.
Well,
that,
exactly. And at that point, we didn't know that Starmer was as right wing as he now seems to be. Of course, signs were there, you know, as people who might have been listening to Sienna Rogers, then of Labourist, during the 2020 leadership campaign, might have heard her say in Navarra Media and other places that that Starmer had always been on the right of his local party, and that was who he organised with. So we knew some of this already. And look, no serious person could have thought it's going to be exactly as left-wing as Corbynism. I mean, I think I saw some optimistic people on the soft left say, I think Starmerism's actually going to be more left-wing than Corbynism, which just shows their kind of, how do I even say? Just a kind of
naivety,
yeah. A strange, deluded optimism where they think that because there are some flaws in Corbynism, that means that if you hand the party over to the people who've been running it for almost a century, very badly most of the time, that's gonna sort the problems out. But yeah, no, I mean, like, on the right-wing ideological project thing, like, you mentioned the Labour Party is doing quite well in the polls at the moment, to say the least.
Yeah, it was pretty, honestly, like, I thought it was a joke.
Yeah.
It was, like, I saw it, I was like, oh, that's someone pretending to be the journalist who tweets out polls. Okay, very funny.
Yeah.
And then I looked at it on my phone, I was like, oh, wow.
So
I mean, it's like a combination of Labour conference bounce, Truswick in the economy, and Labour already about 10 points ahead.
Yeah.
So you add all up and it results in that. But it's still pretty stunning.
And it is, yeah.
And I saw it and I had a big smile briefly. I'm happy to see the Tories laid low. But I just knew that second I was, oh, God. All the Starmerites are going to come into my mentions and be like, oh, told you so.
Yeah, as if it's his sheer magnetism that's winning people over. Yeah, I mean, well, what I'll say about that is that the right-wing ideological project line has provided me with a convenient get-out clause not to have to celebrate Labour being ahead in the polls. Because, I mean, I probably said at some point, I probably have, you know, spoken in haste. Look, I mean, I do a podcast. I say a lot of stupid shit in the heat of the moment. I probably said that Starmer was going to lose the election. But I've never been absolutely certain of that, you know. I've always thought there's a chance that he could be Prime Minister. And you know what? Tony Blair was Prime Minister, Labour Prime Minister, and I hate him more than just about anyone who ever lived. So it's like, it's not such a kind of, you know, a conundrum for me, because like, it really is. It's about a kind of deep-seated ideological objection I have to what he's doing with the Labour Party, more than like, you know, I just think he's unelectable or whatever. And yeah, you can see that in so many aspects of the party, not least, I mean, what do you have in that? You have him advocating a points-based immigration system in the speech. I don't think Keir Starmer personally thinks that that's right. But I think that he's got like deeply held left-wing principles that he's just pushing to the side. But I don't think a point...
He just doesn't care.
Yeah, that's the issue for me. It's, he doesn't care. He will say stuff that he doesn't believe in. And for me, the whole point, the whole thrilling thing about Corbynism was that you didn't have to do that. You didn't have to go and prostrate yourself and with this received wisdom that you apparently have to adhere to get a hearing in British politics.
So I should ask my second question about... real politic.
Ah.
So I'm sure plenty of people have heard at least some episodes of it. I believe you've been running it for over 5 years, because I heard it in 2017 the first time. I think you started in 2016, because
yeah.
I remember you talk about Owen Smith.
Just about the end of it, yeah. So we were looking back at the wreckage of the Owen Smith campaign.
God. I haven't heard a single word from that man in like 6 years. It's wild.
He went into the private sector, didn't he? I can't remember who he was
back into the private sector. Yeah, maybe he went back to work for Pfizer again.
I think he actually did. No, genuinely, oh, I think he did.
Of course he did. Yeah, revolving door. Like it's less a revolving door, more just an open door that he walks in and out of.
Yeah.
But so how did it start? For the first question, like. What made you like sit around and start a podcast about, it's about sort of a film and politics together, hence the name, right?
And thank Twitter user Mark Seddon Jr., who suggested our name to us, and we stuck with it.
Oh yes, the other Mark Seddon.
Yeah, not his father, who has actually appeared. He's not actually his father, but has actually appeared on Real Politic at one point. This was before he started posting things I profoundly disagree with about trans rights, I should add. And it's been our name ever since. You know, it's like, I don't think we've ever seriously considered like changing it, even though we've departed pretty, I mean, we still do a lot of film episodes actually, but it'd be really hard to kind of define us as like a whatever the film and politics podcast we claimed we were originally. I think film and pop culture probably sums it up, because I like talking about my favorite classic rockers as well.
I do think that it's actually really interesting that you guys do that, because there's not many left media projects that don't revolve around politics. Because I remember reading books about the history of the Labour movement and the party, about how some of its early success was built on like newspapers that were run by the left, but just talked about normal stuff like sports, football, even reporting on the royal family, but from like a left perspective, because that was what people wanted to read and they wanted to see different perspectives on it. And it just feels as if like a lot of people on the left are nerds, but like not in a fun way, not in a Transformers way, but in just the like politics is their bread and butter and tea and biscuits and everything. And it's like, yeah, I think it's very refreshing to have people who just like, yeah, no, let's talk about film and music from a perspective.
Yeah, exactly. I think whilst our podcast, I would say it's kind of based around politics, it's not based around like the 24-hour news cycle or the whatever the Twitter equivalent of that now is. I probably need to update my terms of reference in that regard.
The 24-minute news cycle.
The 24-minute news cycle. Yeah, I mean, like, by the time we get an episode out, like, everyone's so over half the shit that we're talking about. So it's like, we have to be good in what we're talking about so that people remember, oh yeah, that thing that happened like 2 weeks ago. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Like, I mean, part of it is just like my personality type is like, I can't bring myself to talk about things I don't care about. And that was like a big problem in school and stuff, like trying to commit to like, you know, trying to do actual work when I just wanted to read the Wikipedia pages of my favorite bands. Like I can absorb a lot of information, but I have to be, my mind has to be telling me, you need to absorb this information. So like, with the Labour Party, that became like a big obsession for me over the last few years. I didn't want to take my eye off the ball in case I did, and then Corbyn wasn't leader anymore. So unfortunately, I had to live through the whole agonizing process of the project falling apart and paying attention the whole time. But yeah,
oh, I feel that.
But absolutely. But then part of that is just like at the last couple of months, like, just been listening to like Bruce Springsteen nonstop. So naturally we got to do an episode making the left case for Bruce Springsteen. Like, it's just, you know, as Lenin said, from each according to their abilities. My ability right now is that I have the ability to talk a lot about Bruce Springsteen. So yeah, that's how we kind of approach the podcast.
So what was, always been going for a lot longer, and the landscape's very different now. What's been your motivation for keeping it going? Because I know from personal experience, like, the motivation to keep podcasting can kind of fall off, particularly as circumstances change. I mean, this is the second season, I'm reviving it, different format. So what's motivated you to keep going? Because you consistently put stuff out.
Well, I mean, we've had our ebbs and flows. And again, it's kind of like when I'm not feeling up to it, like, you know, maybe struggling with depression or whatever, then, but, you know, the show just doesn't really happen. And that's sad. But we try and keep it going, you know, even if I'm out of action, then Yair is off in Montana editing some stuff for us, you know. So we try and have something on the go constantly. And I think, like, as to the longevity, I mean, part of it is just sheer stubbornness. I mean, like, I had, you know, in 2017, I don't want to go into this too much, I'm sure people can find the original stories, but you know, we had this whole thing with the Daily Mail writing up a big hit piece on us, and then that, and it wasn't just the Daily Mail. The Guardian stuck the boot into us. Gabby Hinsliff in her column, the BBC were discussing us. And again, I don't want to just rehash that whole story. I will say it wasn't as it was portrayed in the establishment media. They left out an entire host of our show. We had four hosts and they just wrote about three of us, and that fourth one happened to be the one who had posted the thing that they all objected to. So that's the kind of journalism we're talking about. None of them ever thought fit to correct that. And yeah, like, that was, I mean, they turned up to my co-host Tom's house, the Daily Mail, sent some journalists there. Pretty dispiriting. And you know, we had gone too far on Twitter in certain ways. We'd slagged off people we shouldn't have slagged off. We made some enemies, basically. So whilst a lot of comrades were great to us, there were some who understandably kind of almost didn't stick up for us. So at that point, it was a bit like, fucking hell, why should we? But then there was the other thing in my head, was like, we can't let the bastards win. 5 years later, here we are still doing the same shit.
I mean, I to a lesser extent, no, and by the way, no need to apologize for like talking about what I'm sure was a very traumatic event. Like, you got doxxed by the media. Like, it's a big deal. There's no need to feel bad about talking about it. To a lesser extent, I have like my own. When I was at university, my very first year, I organized a protest, and they dragged me through the disciplinary process for it for like 3 months before ultimately I like the summary of their case basically can be summed up like this. They said I was standing right next to this company's stall, and I found a photo of me that showed me standing like 6 feet, like several feet away from them. And they looked at it and they were like, yeah, it's done. It's fine.
Yeah,
it's fine.
Ridiculous.
So, and I always feel a little bad for talking about that too much, but it affected me. So, yeah, so I understand, just to a lesser extent, but I understand.
Oh, no, totally. I mean, like... So after 2017 for a bit, I was a bit spooked. So I think our output in the last couple of years of the Corbyn leadership, to my eternal regret, was maybe not as confrontational as it could have been. It maybe didn't address some of the lies and the smears head on in a way we could have, because, you know, I didn't want another huge multi-page spread in a tabloid read by millions of people, except this time calling me anti-Semitic or whatever, you know. The misogyny false allegations had been traumatic enough, and, you know, I even had, like, late 2018, I remember in a therapy session, my therapist was telling me you should stop doing the podcast because I was just getting so many right-wing assholes just like saying effectively like triggering things to me. And eventually I was just like, well, look, if I'm going to do this project, like, people with those politics are not going to like me. But what I've got to do is just I've got to unplug a bit, not engage directly with these people, you know, not go looking for a fight necessarily, but I'm sure one will come to me, probably on a daily basis, knowing Twitter especially.
Oh yeah. No, I for me it's less right wingers and more centrists who have a problem with the stuff I do.
Well, that's what I meant, really, but yeah.
Oh, yeah, same thing, yes.
But no, yeah, supporters of a right-wing ideological project.
Very true, so. Yes. But no, I just consistently every time there's a good poll for Labour, I get like a swarm of right-wingers coming into my mentions being like, are you sad? Are you unhappy?
It's crying.
Yeah, what I feel is, I realised this yesterday, I think what they really want is me to just sort of like... sort of crack and be like, yeah, well, you know, well, screw you. Yeah, I am unhappy about it. You know what? I do want Labour to lose. Don't clip that. Anybody listening, don't clip that.
Yeah, they want you to post a picture of your new Conservative Party membership card.
They're just like, aha, I gotcha, you admitted it. That's what they want, I think.
Yeah.
Well, maybe I'm attributing... It just feels like an emotional outburst, really.
I don't think
there's any strategy behind it. But anyway, I'm sure we both agree, and we were talking about it before, that the UK media landscape is very much tilted towards right-wingers in the full sense, like conservatives and very right-wingers. And even when it's not them, it's just liberals. There's no socialist voice, apart from the Morning Star, which is iffy in some ways. What do you, as someone who's been an independent media person, what do you think we can do to tilt the media landscape in a more leftward direction? It's a big question, I understand, if it's not.
This is a difficult one, because, like, whilst, as I say, I have been discussed in mainstream media in somewhat negative terms, I've never myself been... had a hand extended from mainstream media. Actually, tell a lie... During the 2017 election, I think it was, a guy, quite a nice guy called Carl McDonald from The Eye, interviewed me along with, I'm not sure who else, I think maybe Matt Zarb's cousin was interviewed, a friend of yours, I know. I think maybe he was interviewed for that as well. But there was a piece about, it was just about, you know, the kind of the vibrant Twitter culture that was on the left that was calling people slugs and melts and so forth.
You were covered in The Guardian at one point, I believe. Like, I think you dined out on the what they called you for a while, the most irreverent podcast on the left, I think it was.
Yeah, they called us slick. which is amazing because we're proper like 90s basement indie rock lo-fi, you know, like they said we were very rude about half the Labour Party. At the time I thought, half the Labour Party, yeah, you're kind of over-egging how many people in this party support your politics. Now I'd say we're probably rude about more than half the Labour Party. Yeah.
About two-thirds, 70%.
Yeah. With the membership turnover, I think, you know, eventually, you know, that piece might also have been Gabby Hinsliff. She made amends for the initial hatchet job, I guess, by giving us something to dine out on, as you say. I think to try and seriously address your question, I'm just reading it as well, just to try and get my thoughts together.
If the answer is there doesn't seem to be much we can do, I mean, that's also fair, because it is, people have been trying to do this stuff for like 2 decades.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, like, Navarra, who I know you do some stuff with, they're extraordinarily successful for an independent left-wing outlet. Like, from what I understand, in the last couple of years they seem to have like actually broken even and are able to pay people and shit like that.
It's wild.
That's really impressive. Like, we can barely pay ourselves, you know, we can't make a living off this shit. So I've, you know, got nothing but respect for that, for them, you know, for doing that.
So would you say therefore it may be like the left building alternative institutions might be the best way forward then?
I would say,
as you say, getting access to like even the Guardian, the Independent, like the liberal papers, getting access to writing in them or becoming journalists for those is difficult enough. I mean, I did get to write for the Guardian briefly before the 2019 election, and then I wrote an article for them about, mind you, to be fair, I haven't pitched to them in a while. Maybe they would take me if they did. So I last article I wrote for The Guardian was on how Labour lost because of Brexit and not because it was left wing. And I tried writing that, I think, in the midst of the leadership election to try and hopefully influence how people voted. But it didn't seem to make a difference. I remember being in the pub canvassing for Rebecca Long Bailey. And just so many people being like, yeah, I'm just going to vote for Starmer because it seems okay. I'm like, no.
No, that must have been one of those moments. Like, I went down to speak at an extra Labour thing in 2019 around the time of the local elections. And, you know, people there who'd been out canvassing were like, no one's voting for Labour. No. And I was just like astonished to hear this because it was like 2 years after the 2017 election. I was like, they must have just gone to the wrong doors, you know?
Like, yeah. Also, Exeter has a Labour MP.
Technically.
Labour won that seat. Oh, technically, yeah. But in terms of...
Is it Ben Bradshaw?
It is now. He's retiring.
Oh.
Yeah, he's retiring. All these, like, this like parade of Blairites, they're all, like, quitting now that Corbyn's gone. Very, very interesting.
Yeah.
Because obviously Margaret Hodge, I believe, is standing down. After she fought so hard to get re-selected, she stands down a year later.
Yeah. After she threatened to resign as a Labour MP, Margaret Hodge. Got nothing left to lose.
Harriet Harman.
Worst leader in the party's history. Like, I mean, just in terms of, like, just even, like, on the terms of the Labour right, Harman, like, ran the party so badly that she opened the door to Corbyn. Like,
it's amazing that, like, Miliband gets most of the blame for Corbyn, and Harman, who was actually in charge when the whole thing happened, just gets off completely scot-free. It's like, yeah, as it would have been, yeah. It's a popular myth, but I still think it's mainly true. I think Burnham could have won if he hadn't done that abstention. And the only reason he felt he had to was because Harman told him to. If Harman had just said, just do what you would normally do, and I'm not going to mess anything up for you, then he wouldn't have had to feel as if he had to take that stance. Obviously, he didn't have to. I'm not trying to like shill for Burnham here. Like, he's not my politics, but from his perspective, he felt he had to, and he didn't need to.
The reason that Harman doesn't get any blame for opening the door to Corbyn is that the right never want to entertain the fact that Corbyn became leader because the Labour Party had got too right wing. Harmon as leader, more right-wing even than Ed Miliband, who, you know, I think did not live up to his whatever initial promise he had.
So the final final question is about Labour, like specifically about Labour, not it coming up. I remember listening to an RP episode around about the time Starmer won, in which you had a debate and you were the one arguing to stay in the Labour Party. And I'm curious. Yes, I think so. I was curious as to whether you have changed your mind. And if you have, what should people do instead of Labourism?
I have changed my mind.
Okay.
But I haven't I wouldn't necessarily want to instruct others in what to do here, because I feel very lost. And I know as a podcast shit talker, I'm supposed to come on and have all the answers and be like, here is the line, and be supremely confident in the shit I'm saying. That's not my temperament. You know, I am engaged in a constant internal Socratic debate. And basically, I'm not sure what the right approach to the Labour Party is, because I certainly think there are a handful of good Labour MPs remaining, just a handful. I don't rate all of the socialist campaign group. I think some of them should form like an Angela Rayner campaign group or something. I rate the much mistreated Apsana Begum. I rate Zara Sultana, Bel Ribeiro Addy, Ian Byrne. I think whilst I disagree with a lot of his judgment in recent years, John McDonnell is obviously a serious figure on the left. And like, these are people who I would go and campaign for. These are people who I think that the British Parliament is better for having in them. And were I in their local parties, I would turn up to support these people at selection meetings. However, I live in Surrey.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, rather, I should say I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. Is, you know, you're, yeah, I am sorry, unfortunately. but yeah, I mean, we obviously, I mean, this was formerly Sam Gyimah's seat back when he was a very, very right-wing Tory concerned about free speech in universities and stuff.
Oh God, I'd almost forgotten it's the same guy.
Yeah, before he left to join the Lib Dems.
I still can't believe what they did there. I mean, the whole running in Kensington thing was bad, was terrible. But even the fact that they let him in, like this guy who is in every respect not a liberal and not a Democrat in any sense. He's a right-wing libertarian.
You always looked at this guy. This is a guy on the right wing of the Conservative Party, but I guess he had his issues, probably like economistic issues with Brexit, because, you know, he's a neoliberal. And as we know, Brexit was a kind of a war between two different visions of neoliberalism. And so, yeah, maybe he fell on the one that was more stronger trade links with Europe. And so, yeah, he joined the Lib Dems and he ran against Emma Dent Code in Kensington. And were she still an MP, I would, of course, go out and campaign for Emma Dent Code. However, thanks to the efforts of the Observer and the tactical voting, she lost her seat. Guimard didn't win it, but the actual Conservative candidate did. So I mean, just that's kind of a detour there. But like,
It's sort of like I tried to sort of end the podcasts so far, like with both people I've talked to so far. I'm like, on a sort of like call to action, like what we're all feeling quite despondent. Like, what do you think we can sort of positively do? Like, for when I spoke to Chris Jarvis, who's a Green Party councillor, he was like, obviously he wants people involved with the Greens, but also like doing campaign locally. And that was similar for Matt Zubcousin.
Yeah.
His view was like, you pick one issue you care a lot about and you focus on that. So what do you feel people can do from your perspective, or what do you feel you can do?
Well, I think somebody like Matt, who is like a good friend of mine, I think that he should keep doing what he's doing, because he is getting a lot of positive change done in the area of gambling reform. As sad as it is to see the Labour Party backtrack on that and have a conference decked out in the regalia of the gambling lobby. I'm really not a campaigner or an organizer. Like, I'm a fucking loudmouth, essentially.
Like, oh, no, don't do yourself down.
I'm an itinerant late 20s creative type. I don't really have the answers. I'm not Sway. I don't have the strategy for people. But I really think, like, yeah, if you're involved in a campaign you care passionately about, like Matt is with gambling, you know, there's all sorts of things you can do. There's obviously now there's like Enough is Enough and stuff like that. There's the actual trade unions that are behind Enough is Enough. Like, there's some quite radical trade unions when a monarch hasn't just died. Like, so definitely get involved in one of those that suits your profession, or like Unite is a general workers union. Like, somebody who doesn't really have a profession like myself can still be part of Unite. And
I have often wondered which union to join. Unite's probably a very good shout.
Yeah, so yeah, general workers union. So you basically, it's open to anyone.
Thank you very much for coming on, Jack. And like I said, Real Politic, very, very good podcast. I urge people to listen to it.
Oh, thank you. Check it out. And yeah, thank you for having me on. Keep doing what you're doing. When I said that polls are just witchcraft and don't really exist, I was just joking. I trust them if they come from you.
Oh, of course. I wish I had the money to conduct my own polls. It would make me better. But
that's true. Well, I guess I trust them filtered through you. Your analysis. You can cut through the bullshit.
That's very kind.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much again for coming on, Jack. It was very kind of you.
Thank you for having me on.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to that episode of Stats for Lefties. I really appreciate you taking the time to hear what we have to say. To hear the full episode, including the fun half, sign up to our Patreon at patreon.com/leftystats. And I want to give a special thanks to the following comrades who support my work on Patreon at the £5 tier. Alex Wilson, Bert Rothkugel, Chloe Hopkins, Chris Gravel, Daniel Rayner, Conrad, Michael Murray, Mick Mickateer, Neil Barton, Patrick Lefebvre, Pawel Kazimowski, Ruth Holliday, Stephen Carr, Thomas Alexander, and Yudhitha De Silva. Thank you so much, guys. I really do appreciate it. Have a good day.